Meg moved confidently to establish a place in her heart, becoming the first, the only man, she said afterward, that had found a lodgment there. Years later, writing to Kate, Sprague vividly recalled their earlier courtship days. Do you remember the hesitating kiss I stole, and the glowing, blushing face that responded to the touch? I well remember it all, the step forward from the Cleveland meeting, and the enhanced poetical sensation, for it was poetry, if there ever is such in life. For Kate, who acknowledged that she was accustomed to command and be obeyed, to wish and be anticipated, Sprague's cocksure attitude must have presented a welcome challenge. In the weeks that followed, the young couple saw each other frequently. By summer's end, Nettie Chase told Kate that she liked Sprague very much and hoped the two would marry. Nettie's hopes were put on hold, however, as the war continued to escalate, changing the course of countless lives throughout the fractured nation. The tragedies of war came home to the Lincolns with the death of Elmer Ellsworth on May 24, 1861. Young Ellsworth had read law in Lincoln's office and had become so close to the family that he made the journey from Springfield to Washington with them, catching the measles from Willie and Tad along the way. Once in the Capitol, Ellsworth joined the war effort by organizing a group of New York firemen into a Zouave unit, distinguished by their exotic and colorful uniforms. After Virginia seceded from the Union, Ellsworth's Zouaves were among the first troops to cross the Potomac River into Alexandria, a town counting ardent secessionists among its residents, including the proprietor of the Marshall House. Spying a Confederate flag waving above the hotel, Ellsworth dashed up to the roof to confiscate it. Having captured the flag, Ellsworth met the armed hotel manager, secessionist James Jackson, on his way down the stairs. Jackson killed Ellsworth on the spot, only to be shot by Ellsworth's men. Ellsworth's death, as one of the first casualties of the war, was national news and mourned across the country. The bereaved president wrote a personal note of condolence to Ellsworth's parents, praising the young man whose body lay in state in the East Room. Nicolay confessed that he had been quite unable to keep the tears out of my eyes whenever he thought of Ellsworth. After the funeral, Mary was presented with the bloodied flag for which Ellsworth had given his life. But the horrified First Lady, not wanting to be reminded of the sad event, quickly had it packed away. With more than enough troubles to occupy him at home, Lincoln faced a tangled situation abroad. A member of the British Parliament had introduced a resolution urging England to accord the Southern Confederacy belligerent status. If passed, the resolution would give Confederate ships the same rights in neutral ports enjoyed by federal ships. Britain's textile economy depended on cotton furnished by Southern plantations. Unless the British broke the Union blockade to ensure a continuing supply of cotton, the great textile mills in Manchester and Leeds would be forced to cut back or come to a halt. Merchants would lose money, and thousands of workers would lose their jobs. Seward feared that England would back the South simply to feed its own factories. While the younger branch of the British stock might support freedom, he told his wife, the aristocrats, concerned more with economics than morality, would become the ally of the traitors. To prevent this from happening, he was trying to get a bold remonstrance through the cabinet before it is too late. He hoped not only to halt further thoughts of recognition of the Confederacy, but to ensure that the British would respect the Union blockade and refuse even informally to meet with the three Southern commissioners who had been sent to London to negotiate for the Confederacy. To achieve these goals, Seward was willing to wage war. "God damn 'em, I'll give 'em hell," he told Sumner, thrusting his foot in the air as he spoke. On May 21st, Seward brought Lincoln a surly letter drafted for Charles Francis Adams to read verbatim to Lord John Russell, Britain's Foreign Secretary. Lincoln recognized immediately that the tone was too abrasive for a diplomatic communication. While decisive action might be necessary to prevent Britain from any form of overt sympathy with the South, Lincoln had no intention of fighting two wars at once. All his life, he had taken care not to send letters written in anger. Now, to mitigate the harshness of the draft, he altered the tone of the letter at numerous points. Where Seward had claimed that the president was surprised and grieved that no protest had been made against unofficial meetings with the Southern commissioners, Lincoln wrote simply that the president regrets. Where Seward threatened that no one of these proceedings, informal or formal recognition, or breaking the blockade, will be borne, Lincoln shifted the phrase to will pass unnoticed. Most important, where Seward had indicated that the letter be read directly to the British Foreign Secretary, Lincoln insisted that it serve merely for Adams' guidance and should not be read or shown to anyone. Still, the central message remained clear, a warning to Britain that if the vexing issues were not resolved and Britain decided to fraternize with our domestic enemy, then a war between the United States and Britain may ensue, caused by the action of Great Britain, not our own. In that event, Britain would forever lose the sympathies and the affections of the only nation on whose sympathies and affections she has a natural claim. Thus, a threatening message that might have embroiled the Union in two wars at the same time became instead the basis for a hard-line policy that effectively interrupted British momentum toward recognizing the Confederacy. Furthermore, France, whose ministers had promised to act in concert with Britain, followed suit. This was a critical victory for the Union, preventing, for the time being, the recognition that would have conferred legitimacy on the Confederacy in the eyes of the world, weakened Northern morale, and accorded currency to Southern bonds. History would later give Secretary of State Seward high marks for his role in preventing Britain and France from intervening in the war. He is considered by some to have been the ablest American diplomatist of the century. But here, as was so often the case, Lincoln's unseen hand had shaped critical policy. Only 3 months earlier, the frontier lawyer had confessed to Seward that he knew little of foreign affairs. His revisions of the dispatch, however, exhibit the sophisticated prowess of a veteran statesman. He had analyzed a complex situation and sought the least provocative way to neutralize a potential enemy while making crystal clear his country's position. Seward was slowly but inevitably coming to appreciate Lincoln's remarkable abilities. It is due to the president to say that his magnanimity is almost superhuman, he told his wife in mid-May. His confidence and sympathy increase every day. As Lincoln began to trust his own abilities, Seward became more confident in him. In early June, he told Francis, Executive skill and vigor are rare qualities. The president is the best of us, but he needs constant and assiduous cooperation. Though the feisty New Yorker would continue to debate numerous issues with Lincoln in the years ahead, exactly as Lincoln had hoped and needed him to do, Seward would become his most faithful ally in the cabinet. He committed himself to his chief, Nicolay and Hay observed, not only without reserve, but with a sincere and devoted personal attachment. Seward's mortification at not having received his party's nomination in 1860 never fully abated, but he no longer felt compelled to belittle Lincoln to ease his pain. He settled into his position as Secretary of State, and his optimistic and gregarious nature reasserted itself. Once more, his elaborate parties and receptions became the talk of Washington. 5 days after the dispatch was sent, Seward hosted a brilliant assemblage at his new home. All the rooms were full, with dancing in one, drinks in another, and good conversation all around. Seward was in excellent spirits, moving easily among cabinet members, military officers, diplomats, and senators. Even white-haired Secretary Wells, who, it was mockingly remarked, should have died, to all intents and purposes, 20 years ago, was having such a good time that he seemed good for at least 20 years more. Lincoln looked to Chase for guidance on the complex problem of financing a war at a time when the government was heavily in debt. The economic panic of 1857, corruption in the Buchanan administration, and the partial dismemberment of the Union had taken a massive toll on the government coffers. With Congress not in session to authorize new tariffs and taxes, Chase was forced to rely on government loans to sustain war expenditures. Banks held back at first, demanding higher interest rates than the government could afford to pay. But eventually, Chase cobbled together enough revenue to meet expenses until Congress convened. Chase later noted proudly that in the early days of the war, Lincoln relied on him to carry out functions that ordinarily belonged to the War Department. According to Chase, he assumed the principal charge of preventing the key border states of Kentucky, Missouri, and Tennessee from falling into secessionist hands. He authorized a loyal state senator from Kentucky to muster 20 companies. He drew up the orders that allowed Andrew Johnson, the only senator from a Confederate state who remained loyal to the Union, to raise regiments in Tennessee. He believed himself instrumental in keeping Kentucky and Missouri in the Union, seriously underestimating Lincoln's critical role. Indeed, Chase would never cease to underestimate Lincoln, nor to resent the fact that he had lost the presidency to a man he considered his inferior. In late April, he presumptuously sent Lincoln a New York Times article highly derogatory of the administration. "The president and the cabinet at Washington are far behind the people," the Times argued. "They are like a person just aroused from sleep and in a state of dreamy half-consciousness." "This charge," Chase informed Lincoln, "has too much truth in it." Lincoln did not reply, well understanding Chase's implacable yearning for the presidency. But for now, he needed the Ohioans' enormous talents and total cooperation. Cameron, meanwhile, found the task of running the War Department unbearable. Unable to manage his vast responsibilities, he turned to both Seward and Chase for help. "Oh, it was a terrible time," Cameron remembered years later. "We were entirely unprepared for such a conflict, and for the moment at least absolutely without even the simplest instruments with which to engage in war. We had no guns, and even if we had, they would have been of but little use, for we had no ammunition to put in them, no powder, no saltpeter, no bullets, no anything." The demands placed on the War Department in the early days of the war were indeed excruciating. Not only were weapons in short supply, but uniforms, blankets, horses, medical supplies, food, and everything necessary to outfit the vast numbers of volunteer soldiers arriving daily in Washington were unobtainable. It would have taken thousands of personnel to handle the varied functions of the Quartermaster's Department, the Ordnance Office, the Engineering Department, the Medical Office, and the Pay Department. Yet in 1861, the entire War Department consisted of fewer than 200 people, including clerks, messengers, and watchmen. As Cameron lamented afterward, "I was certainly not in a place to be envied." Lincoln later explained that with so large a number of disloyal persons infiltrating every department, the government could not rely on official agents to manage contracts for manufacturing the weapons and supplies necessary to maintain a fighting force. With the cabinet's unanimous consent, He directed Chase to dispense millions of dollars to a small number of trusted private individuals to negotiate and sign contracts that would mobilize the military. Acting without compensation, the majority of these men did their utmost under the circumstances. A few, including Alexander Cummings, one of Cameron's lieutenants, would bring shame to the War Department. As spring gave way to the stifling heat of a Washington summer, Lincoln began work on the message he would deliver to Congress when the House and Senate assembled in special session on July 4th. Needing time to think, he placed an embargo on all office seekers, so strict that they were not even allowed entry into the White House. As he labored in his newfound quiet, congressmen and senators gathered at Willard's and Brown's hotels, exchanging greetings and trading stories. They all anticipated, one reporter stated, that they would soon ascertain the exact intentions of the administration through the medium of the president's message. Lincoln worked long hours on the text, shifting words, condensing, deleting sentences. Even Senator Orville Browning, his old friend from Illinois who had come to see him, was told he was busy. But Lincoln overheard Browning talking and sent for him. It was after 9 p.m. on July 3rd, and he had just that moment finished writing. "He said he wished to read it to me, and did so," Browning recorded in his diary. "It is an able state paper, and will fully meet the expectations of the country." Lincoln did not personally deliver his address on Capitol Hill. President Thomas Jefferson had denounced presidential appearances before Congress, considering them a monarchical remnant of the English system, where kings personally opened parliamentary sessions. Since Jefferson, presidents had submitted their written messages to be read by a clerk. Yet if the practice lacked theatricality, Lincoln's arguments against secession and for the necessity of executive action in the midst of rebellion left an indelible impression. He traced the history of the struggle and called on Congress to give the legal means for making this contest a short and a decisive one. He asked for at least 400,000 men and $400 million of dollars, a less sum per head than was the debt of our revolution. "A right result at this time will be worth more to the world than 10 times the men and 10 times the money," he assured Congress. "For this issue embraces more than the fate of these United States. It presents to the whole family of men the question whether a constitutional republic or a democracy, a government of the people by the same people, can or cannot maintain its territorial integrity against its own domestic foes." "This is essentially a people's contest," the president asserted. "On the side of the Union, it is a struggle for maintaining in the world that form and substance of government whose leading object is to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life." As evidence of the capacity of free institutions to better the condition of the people, beyond any example in the world, he cited the regiments of the Union Army, in which there is scarcely one from which could not be selected a president, a cabinet, a Congress, and perhaps a court, abundantly competent to administer the government itself. Northern newspapers generally praised the message, though some failed to appreciate the rigor of Lincoln's appeal and the clear grace of his language. "In spite of obvious faults in style," the New York Times correspondent conceded, "I venture to say it will add to the popularity of the rail splitter. It is evidently the production of an honest, clear-headed, and straightforward man, and its direct and forcible logic and quaint style of illustration will cause it to be read with peculiar pleasure by the masses of the people. More important, the Congress responded with alacrity. Its members authorized more money and an even larger mobilization of troops than the President had requested. In addition, they provided retroactive authority for nearly all of Lincoln's executive actions taken before they convened, remaining silent only on his suspension of habeas corpus. With the Southern Democrats gone, the Republicans had a substantial majority. And for the moment, Northern Democrats also acceded, their dislike of Republicans overshadowed by patriotic fervor. Not everyone was pleased. Abolitionists and radical Republicans found the message disheartening. "No mention is at all made of slavery," Frederick Douglass lamented. "Anyone reading that document, with no previous knowledge of the United States, would never dream from anything there written that we have a slaveholding war waged upon the government, while all here know that that is the vital and animating motive of the rebellion." Radicals tended to blame Seward for Lincoln's reluctance to emphasize the role of slavery. "We have an honest president," Wendell Phillips, the abolitionist editor, proclaimed before a celebratory crowd on the 4th of July. "But, distrusting the strength of the popular feeling behind him, he listens overmuch to Seward." Men like Phillips, Thaddeus Stevens, and Charles Sumner could never forgive Seward for apparently lowering the anti-slavery banner he had once carried so triumphantly. Seward was accustomed to criticism, however, and while he had the president beside him, he remained secure in his position. Meanwhile, the events of the war itself began to reshape the old order in ways few realized. At Fort Monroe, at the tip of the peninsula in Virginia, a bold decision by General Benjamin Butler proved a harbinger of things to come. One night, three fugitive slaves arrived at the fort after escaping from the Confederate battery that their master had ordered them to help build. When an agent of their owner demanded their return, Butler refused. The rebels were using slaves in the field to support their troops, Butler argued. The slaves were therefore contraband of war, and the federal government was no longer obliged to surrender them to their masters. Coming from Butler, a conservative Democrat from Massachusetts who had run for governor on the Breckinridge ticket in 1860, the decision delighted Republican stalwarts who had previously objected to Butler's high position. Butler himself would soon be equally delighted by Lincoln's magnanimity in making him a brigadier general. "I will accept the commission," Butler gratefully told Lincoln, "but there is one thing I must say to you, as we don't know each other, that, as a Democrat, I opposed your election and did all I could for your opponent. But I shall do no political act and loyally support your administration as long as I hold your commission. And when I find any act that I cannot support, I shall bring the commission back at once and return it to you." Lincoln replied, "That is frank, that is fair. But I want to add one thing. When you see me doing anything that for the good of the country ought not to be done, come and tell me so, and why you think so, and then perhaps you won't have any chance to resign your commission." Had Butler known Lincoln, he would have been less astonished. The president commissioned officers with the same eye toward coalition building that he displayed in constructing his cabinet. Butler's order was approved by both Lincoln and Cameron, and eventually the Congress passed a confiscation law ending the rights of masters over fugitive slaves utilized to support the Confederate troops. Even conservative Monty Blair applauded Butler. "You were right when you declared secession niggers contraband of war," he told his fellow Democrat. "The secessionists have used them to do all their fortifying." Blair's approval of Butler's measure as an act of war did not mean that he advocated emancipation. On the contrary, he advised Butler to improve the code by restricting its operations to working people, leaving the secessionists to take care of the non-working classes. The Union should provide safe harbor only to the pick of the lot, the strong-bodied slaves who were helping the rebels in the field. Women and children and other unproductive laborers should be left for their southern masters to house and feed. Lincoln, as usual, was slowly formulating his own position on the slavery question. He told Blair that Butler's action raised a very important subject, one requiring some thought in view of the numbers of Negroes we were likely to have on hand in virtue of this new doctrine. Indeed, in the weeks that followed, hundreds of courageous slaves worked their way into Union lines. The situation worried Lincoln. At this juncture, he still favored compensated emancipation and voluntary colonization, allowing blacks who wished to do so to return to their original homeland in Africa. Most important, he knew that any hint of total direct emancipation would alienate the border states, whose continued loyalty was essential for victory, and would shatter the Republicans' fragile alliance with Northern Democrats. By shying from emancipation in these early months of the war, Lincoln aligned himself with the majority of the Northern people, the Republican Congress, and the whole of his cabinet. 2 weeks into its session, the House passed a resolution declaring that the purpose of the war was to preserve the Union, not to eliminate slavery. Even Chase, the most fervent anti-slavery man in the cabinet, agreed that at this time the sword of total abolition should be left in the sheath. If the conflict were drawn out, however, he told the historian John Motley, if we find it much more difficult and expensive in blood and treasure to put it down than we anticipated, then the sword would be drawn. We do not wish this. We deplore it because of the vast confiscation of property and of the servile insurrections, too horrible to contemplate, which would follow. We wish the Constitution and Union as it is, with slavery as a municipal institution, existing till such time as each state in its wisdom thinks fit to mitigate or abolish it. But if the issue be distinctly presented, death to the American Republic or death to slavery, slavery must die. By mid-July, the outcry in the North for some form of significant action against the rebels reached fever pitch. "Forward to Richmond," blared the headline in the New York Tribune. Senator Trumbull introduced a resolution calling for the immediate movement of troops and the occupation of Richmond before the 20th July, the date set for the Confederate Congress to convene. General Scott hesitated, believing the army still unprepared for a major offensive. But Lincoln feared that without action, the morale of both the troops and the general public would diminish. European leaders would interpret Northern inaction as a faltering resolve in the Union. General Irvin McDowell, a brigadier general from Ohio, devised a plan to engage the rebel forces, under command of General Beauregard, at Manassas, 26 miles southwest of Washington. It was an intelligent plan. Many Northerners had come to see Manassas as a terrible, unknown, mysterious something, filled by countless thousands of the most ferocious warriors, poised to attack Washington, D.C. "Foreigners do not understand," Bates confided to a friend, "why we should allow a hostile army to remain so long almost in sight of the capital if we were able to drive them off." With 30,000 Union troops at his disposal, McDowell could overrun Beauregard's forces so long as Union General Robert Patterson prevented the 9,000 Confederate troops under General Joseph Johnston at Winchester, Virginia, from joining Beauregard. On June 29th, Lincoln and his cabinet approved McDowell's plan. The Battle of Bull Run, as it later became known in the North, began in the early morning hours of Sunday, July 21st. As the roar of the artillery reached the White House, Elizabeth Grimsley recalled, the excitement grew intense. As far away as the Blair estate in Silver Spring, Monty's sister Elizabeth took a walk in the woods to stop the roar in her ears. But the sound of the guns only increased, as soldiers on both sides of the battlefield were discovering the gruesome carnage of war. Hundreds of Washingtonians hastily prepared picnic baskets filled with bread and wine. They raced to the hill at Centerville and the fields below to witness what most presumed would be an easy victory for the North. Senators, congressmen, government employees, and their families peered through opera glasses to survey the battlefield. After an unusually heavy discharge, the British journalist William Russell overheard one woman exclaim, "That is splendid! Oh, my! Is not that first rate? I guess we will be in Richmond this time tomorrow." While Lincoln attended church, the Union troops pressed forward, forcing the rebels farther south into the woods. At midday, news of what seemed a complete Union victory reached Lincoln and the members of his cabinet at the telegraph office in the War Department. In the crowded space that housed the telegraph instruments, operators found it hard to focus on their responsibilities. Each new dispatch, the New York Times noted, was posted and read aloud to hundreds of people gathered in front of the Willard Hotel. The jubilant throng cheered vehemently and seemed fairly intoxicated with joy. Even as the crowds celebrated in the streets, the fiercest stage of the fighting was just beginning. The Confederates refused to give up, rallied by the steadfast General Thomas Jackson. "There is Jackson with his Virginians, standing like a stone wall," General Barnard Bee reportedly shouted to inspire his troops, and both Confederate and Union soldiers thereafter referred to Jackson as Stonewall Jackson. The two sides fought valiantly in the blazing sun as the line of battle shifted back and forth. At 3 p.m., Lincoln was in the telegraph office studying the maps on the wall and waiting anxiously for the updated bulletins, which arrived in 15-minute intervals. The telegraph line stretched only as far as the Fairfax courthouse. News from the battlefront farther south was relayed to Fairfax by a troop of mounted couriers established by the young Andrew Carnegie, who then worked with the U.S. Military Telegraph Corps. Noting some confusion in the battlefield reports, Lincoln crossed over to General Scott's headquarters, a small three-storied brick house jammed with officers and clerks. Waking Scott from a nap, Lincoln expressed his concern. Scott, Nicolay reported, simply confirmed his confidence in a successful result and composed himself for another nap when the president left. Succeeding dispatches became uniformly positive, conveying assurances that the Confederate lines had broken. At about 4:30, the telegraph operator proclaimed that the Union Army had achieved a glorious victory. Lincoln decided to take his usual carriage ride, accompanied by Tad, Willie, and Secretary Bates. As they rode together to the Navy Yard to talk with John A. Dahlgren, one of Lincoln's favorite naval officers, Bates confided his anxiety for his son Coulter, who was soon to be sent into battle. When young Coulter departed to join his regiment, Bates wrote, it was the first time he ever left home. The carriage ride came to a close with Bates feeling a new intimacy with his president. As Lincoln relaxed with Bates in his carriage, the tide of battle turned against the Union. Confederate General Johnston's forces had escaped General Patterson's grasp, and by mid-afternoon, 9,000 fresh Confederate troops arrived to reinforce Beauregard. McDowell had no reserve troops left. A sudden swoop, and a body of Confederate cavalry rushed down upon our columns, Edmund Stedman reported from the battlefield. They came from the woods, and infantry poured out behind them. Exhausted Union infantrymen, including Sprague's 1st Rhode Island Regiment, broke ranks. An uncontrolled retreat toward Washington began, further confused by the panicked flight of horrified spectators. Indeed, an acquaintance of Chase's who had witnessed the battle never stopped until he reached New York. Young Stedman was appalled by the raging scene. Army wagons, sutlers' teams, and private carriages choked the passage, tumbling against each other amid clouds of dust and sickening sights and sounds. Muskets and small arms were discarded along the way. Wounded soldiers pled for help. Horses running free exacerbated the human stampede. The shocking news reached Washington in Lincoln's absence. "General McDowell's army in full retreat through Centerville," the dispatch read. "The day is lost. Save Washington and the remnants of the army." Seward grabbed the telegram and ran to the White House. With a terribly frightened and excited look on his face, he asked Nicolay for the latest news. Lincoln's secretary read him an earlier exultant dispatch. "Tell no one. That is not so. The battle is lost," Seward revealed. "Find the president and tell him to come immediately to General Scott's." When Lincoln returned, his young aides relayed Seward's message. He listened in silence, they later reported, without the slightest change of feature or expression, and walked away to Army headquarters. He remained there with Scott and his cabinet until a telegram from McDowell verified the loss. Immediate reinforcements were summoned to defend the capital. With no further recourse, the disconsolate team dispersed. Oh, what a sad, long, weary day has this Sabbath been, Elizabeth Blair told her husband. For Simon Cameron, the day brought a sharper personal grief. His brother, James, in the service of Colonel William Sherman's brigade, was among the nearly 900 soldiers killed. "I loved my brother," Cameron wrote Chase, "as only the poor and lonely can love those with whom they have toiled and struggled up the rugged hill of life's success. But he died bravely in the discharge of his duty." Seward stayed up past midnight, composing a letter to Francis. "Everything is being done that mortal man can do. Scott is grieved and disappointed. What went out, an army, is surging back toward Washington as a disorganized mob. They fought well, did nobly, and apparently had gained the day, when some unreasonable alarm started a retreat. If the officers had experience, and the men discipline, they could be rallied, and could be marched clear back to the field." Lincoln returned to the White House, where he watched the returning soldiers straggle down the street, listened to the mournful sounds of ambulances, and sat for hours with various senators and congressmen who had witnessed the battle from the hill. Early the following morning, with rain pouring down, General Scott arrived, urging Mary to take the children to the north until Washington was deemed safe from capture. Elizabeth Grimsley recollected the exchange as Mary turned to her husband. "Will you go with us?" she asked. "Most assuredly I will not leave at this juncture," he replied. "Then I will not leave you at this juncture," she answered with finality. Lincoln did not sleep that dreadful night. Finding his only comfort in forward motion, he began drafting a memo incorporating the painful lessons of Bull Run into a coherent future military policy. Understanding that the disorder of the newly formed troops had contributed to the debacle, he called for the forces to be constantly drilled, disciplined, and instructed. Furthermore, when he learned that soldiers preparing to end their 3 months of service had led the retreat, Lincoln proposed to let all those short-termers who declined to enter the longer service be discharged as rapidly as circumstances will permit. Anticipating European reactions to the defeat, he determined to move, with all possible dispatch, to make the blockade operative. That night, a telegram was also sent to General George McClellan in Western Virginia, with orders to come to Washington and take command of the Army of the Potomac. Lincoln then devised a strategy consisting of three advances: a second stand at Manassas, a move down the Mississippi toward Memphis, and a drive from Cincinnati to East Tennessee. If there were nothing else of Abraham Lincoln for history to stamp him with, Walt Whitman reflected, it is enough to send him with his wreath to the memory of all future time, that he endured that hour, that day, bitterer than gall, indeed a crucifixion day, that it did not conquer him, that he unflinchingly stemmed it, and resolved to lift himself and the Union out of it. Recriminations were plentiful. The Democratic New York Herald placed responsibility on a weak, inharmonious, and inefficient cabinet. General Patterson was blamed for failing to keep Johnston's troops from joining Beauregard. 2 weeks ago, Chase self-righteously complained to a friend, I urged the sending of Fremont to this command, and had it been done, we should now have been rejoicing over a great victory. Still, the historian James Rowley concludes that public censure touched too lightly on Lincoln, who should have held back the assault until the troops were ready. The sun rises, but shines not, Whitman wrote of the dismal day after the defeat. Rain continued to fall as the defeated troops flooded into Washington. From his window at Willard's, Russell observed these bedraggled soldiers. Some had neither greatcoats nor shoes. Others were covered with blankets. Nettie Chase recalled being awakened in the gray dawn by the heavy, unwanted rumbling of laden wagons passing along the street below. Thinking at first they were bound for market, she was sickened to realize they were filled with wounded soldiers heading for the hospital nearby. To relieve the crowded hospital wards, Chase opened his spacious home to nearly a dozen wounded men. Bishop McIlvaine, a friend visiting from Ohio who happened to be staying with Chase at the time, tended to the sick and dying. Nettie recalled the bishop's uneasiness when one of the wounded men cursed loudly with each pain. Just let me swear a bit, the young man entreated the stunned bishop. It helps me stand the hurting. The dreadful disaster of Sunday can scarcely be mentioned, Stanton wrote to former President Buchanan 5 days after Bull Run. The imbecility of this administration culminated in that catastrophe, he pronounced with a sycophantic nod to his former boss, calling the fiasco the result of Lincoln's running the machine for 5 months. The capture of Washington seems now to be inevitable. During the whole of Monday and Tuesday, it might have been taken without any resistance. Even now I doubt whether any serious opposition to the entrance of the Confederate forces could be offered. Historians have long pondered the reluctance of the Confederates to capitalize on their victory by attacking Washington. Jefferson Davis later cited an overweening confidence after the initial victory that led to lax decisions. General Johnston observed that hundreds of volunteers, believing the war already won, simply left their regiments and returned home to exhibit the trophies picked up on the field. Other soldiers melted into the countryside, accompanying wounded comrades to faraway hospitals. Perhaps the most straightforward explanation of both the dismal Union retreat and the Confederate failure to march into Washington is manifest in the plain assessment Nancy Bates posted to her young niece Hester. Well, we fought all day Sunday. Our men were so tired that they had to come away from Manassas. I expect that the others were very tired, too, or they would have followed our men. While Lincoln brooded in private, confiding in Browning that he was very melancholy, he maintained a stoic public image. He refrained from answering Horace Greeley's acerbic letter, written in black despair, after the Tribune editor had endured a week without sleep. You are not considered a great man, Greeley charged, adding that if the Confederacy could not be defeated, Lincoln should not fear to sacrifice himself to his country. Despite a blizzard of such indictments, Lincoln listened patiently to reports from the field of what went wrong. He told humorous stories to provide relief, and in the days that followed, with Seward by his side, he visited a number of regiments, raising spirits at every stop along the way. At Fort Corcoran, on the Virginia side of the Potomac, he asked Colonel William T. Sherman if he could address the troops. Sherman was delighted, though he asked Lincoln to discourage all cheering. After the boasts that preceded Bull Run, he explained, what we needed were cool, thoughtful, hard-fighting soldiers. No more hurrahing, no more humbug. Lincoln agreed, proceeding to deliver what Sherman considered one of the neatest, best, and most feeling addresses he had ever heard. Lincoln commented on the lost battle, but emphasized the high duties that still devolved on us, and the brighter days yet to come. At various points, the soldiers began to cheer, but Lincoln promptly checked them, saying, "Don't cheer, boys. I confess I rather like it myself, but Colonel Sherman here says it is not military, and I guess we had better defer to his opinion." The president closed his graceful speech with a pledge to provide the troops with all they needed, and even encouraged them to call on him personally in case they were wronged. One aggrieved officer took him at his word, revealing that as a 3-month volunteer he had tried to leave, but Sherman had threatened to shoot him. In a stage whisper, Lincoln counseled the officer, "Well, if I were you, and he threatened to shoot, I would not trust him, for I believe he would do it." The response produced gales of laughter among the men, while upholding Sherman's discipline. Northern public opinion reflected Lincoln's firm resolve. Republican newspapers across the land reported a renewed patriotism, bringing thousands of volunteers to sign up for 3 years. "Let no loyal man be discouraged by the reverse," the Chicago Tribune proclaimed. "Like the great Antaeus, who, when thrown to the ground, gathered strength from the contact with Mother Earth and arose refreshed and stronger than before, to renew the contest, so of the Sons of Liberty. The loss of this battle will only nerve them to greater efforts." Several papers compared the Bull Run disaster to George Washington's early defeats in the Revolutionary War, which eventually resulted in triumph at Yorktown. "The spirit of the people is now thoroughly aroused," the New York Times announced, "and what is equally important, it has been chastened and moderated by the stern lessons of experience." With the stunning reversal and rout at Bull Run, however, Northern delusions of easy triumph dissolved. "It is pretty evident now that we have underrated the strength, the resources, and the temper of the enemy," the Times conceded, "and we have been blind, moreover, to the extraordinary nature of the country over which the contest is to be waged, and to its wonderful facilities for defense." Yet the harrowing lessons of Bull Run generated a perverse confidence that the North could take comfort in already knowing the worst that could happen. It was unimaginable, in the anxious chaos following the first major battle of the Civil War, that far worse was yet to come. Chapter 14. I Do Not Intend to Be Sacrificed. "Nothing but a patent pill was ever so suddenly famous," it was said of George B. McClellan when he arrived in Washington on July 27, 1861, to take command of the Army of the Potomac. "That dear old domestic bird, the public," an essayist later wrote, "was sure she had brooded out an eagle chick at last." Among the Union's youngest generals at 34, the handsome, athletic McClellan seemed to warrant the acclaim and great expectation. He was the scion of a distinguished Philadelphia family. His father graduated from Yale College and the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. His mother was elegant and genteel. Educated in excellent schools, including West Point, McClellan had served on the staff of General Scott in the Mexican War. Most important, to a public looking for deliverance, he had recently defeated a guerrilla band in western Virginia, handing the North its only victory, albeit a small one. To the nerve-worn residents of Washington, McClellan seemed the man on horseback, just the leader to mold the disorganized Union troops into a disciplined army capable of returning to Manassas and defeating the enemy. Within days of his arrival, one diarist noted, Washington itself had assumed a more martial look. Hotel bars no longer overflowed with drunken soldiers, nor did troops wander the city late at night in search of lodgings. The young general seemed able to mystically project his own self-confidence onto the demoralized troops, restoring their faith in themselves and their hope for the future. "You have no idea how the men brighten up now when I go among them. I can see every eye glisten," he wrote proudly to his wife, Mary Ellen. "Yesterday they nearly pulled me to pieces in one regiment. You never heard such yelling." Lincoln hoped that between Scott's seasoned wisdom as general-in-chief and McClellan's vitality and force, he would finally have a powerfully effective team. From the start, however, McClellan viewed Scott as the great obstacle to both his own ambition for sole authority and to his larger strategy in the war. Less than 2 weeks after assuming command of the Army of the Potomac, McClellan questioned Scott's belief that the rush of reinforcements to Washington had secured the capital. In a letter to General Scott, which he copied to the president, he argued that his army was entirely insufficient for the emergency, for the enemy has at least 100,000 men in our front. Scott was furious that his judgment had been called into question, correctly insisting that McClellan was grossly exaggerating the opposition forces. It would not be the last of the imperious general's miscalculations. Lincoln temporarily defused the animosity by asking McClellan to withdraw his offending letter, but the discord between the two generals continued to escalate. Scott wanted to employ concentric pressure on the rebels in different theaters of war. McClellan declared that only with an overwhelming force concentrated on Virginia could he put an end to hostilities. All other engagements he considered secondary, dispersing resources needed to crush the rebels in one campaign. In his almost daily letters to his wife, McClellan recognized that his disagreements with Scott might result in a mortal enmity on his part against me. Justifying his unwillingness to make peace with Scott, he referred frequently to his sense of destiny. It was his conviction that God has placed a great work in my hands. He felt that by some strange operation of magic, he had become the power of the land, and if the people call upon me to save the country, I must save it, and cannot respect anything that is in the way. McClellan told her that he received letter after letter begging him to assume the presidency or become a dictator. While he would eschew the presidency, he would cheerfully take the dictatorship and agree to lay down my life when the country is saved. Frustrated by the lack of response to his constant calls for more troops and equipment, McClellan insisted that Scott was a perfect imbecile, a dotard, even possibly a traitor. Refusing to acknowledge that the dispute represented an honest clash of opinions, McClellan insisted that the root of contention with Scott was the veteran's eternal jealousy of all who acquire any distinction. As the row between the two men intensified, McClellan decided to ignore Scott's communications, though the chain of command required that he inform his superior officer of his position and the number of troops at his disposal. Scott was indignant. The remedy by arrest and trial before a court-martial would probably soon cure the evil, Scott told Secretary of War Cameron. But he feared a public conflict would be highly encouraging to the enemies and depressing to the friends of the Union. Hence, my long forbearance. Instead, he proposed that as soon as the President could make other arrangements, he himself would gladly retire, being, as I am, unable to ride in the saddle, or to walk, by reason of dropsy in my feet and legs, and paralysis in the small of the back. For 2 months, Lincoln tried to restore harmony between his commanders. He spent many hours at General Scott's headquarters, listening to the old warrior and attempting to mollify him. He made frequent visits to McClellan's headquarters, situated in a luxurious house at the corner of Lafayette Square, not far from Seward's new home. The upstairs rooms were reserved for McClellan's private use. The parlors downstairs were occupied by the telegraph office, with dozens of staff smoking, reading the papers, and writing. Sometimes McClellan welcomed Lincoln's visits. On other occasions he felt them a waste of time. "I have just been interrupted here by the President and Secretary Seward, who had nothing very particular to say except some stories to tell." Observers noted with consternation that McClellan often kept Lincoln waiting in the downstairs room, together with other common mortals. British reporter William Russell began to pity the President, who would call only to be told that the General was lying down, very much fatigued. Nonetheless, so long as he believed in McClellan's positive influence on the army, Lincoln tolerated such flagrant breaches of protocol. The first public dissatisfaction with McClellan's performance began to emerge as the autumn leaves began to fall. While Washingtonians delighted in his magnificent reviews of more than 50,000 troops marching in straight columns to the sounds of 100-gun salutes, with not a mistake made, not a hitch, they grew restive with the failure of the troops to leave camp. Undeterred, McClellan insisted to his wife that he would not move until he was certain that he was completely ready to take on the enemy. "A long time must yet elapse before I can do this, and I expect all the newspapers to abuse me for delay, but I will not mind that." Radical Republicans, who had initially applauded McClellan's appointment, began to turn on him when they learned he had issued a slave-catching order requiring commanders to return fugitive slaves to their masters. McClellan repeatedly emphasized that he was fighting to preserve the integrity of the Union and the power of the government, and that to achieve that overriding goal, the country could not afford to raise up the Negro question. Coming under attack, he sought cover from his Democratic friends. "Help me to dodge the nigger," he entreated Samuel Barlow of New York. "We want nothing to do with him." At the first whiff of censure, McClellan shifted blame onto any other shoulder but his own, onto Scott's failure to muster necessary resources, onto the incompetence of the cabinet, some of the greatest geese I have ever seen, enough to tax the patience of Job. He considered Seward a meddling, officious, incompetent little puppy, Wells weaker than the most garrulous old woman, and Bates an old fool. He was disgusted by the rascality of Cameron, and though he commended Monty Blair's courage, he did not altogether fancy him. Only Chase was spared his scorn, perhaps because the Treasury Secretary had sent a flattering letter before McClellan was called to Washington, in which he claimed that he was the one responsible for the general's promotion to Major General. Impatience with McClellan mounted when one of his divisions suffered a crushing defeat at a small engagement on October 21, 1861. Having learned that the rebels had pulled back some of their troops from Leesburg, Virginia, McClellan ordered General Charles P. Stone to mount a slight demonstration on your part in order to move them. Stone assumed that he would have the help of a neighboring division, which McClellan had ordered back to Washington without informing Stone. Colonel Edward Baker, Lincoln's close friend from Illinois, was killed in action, along with 49 of his men, when the Confederates trapped them at the river's edge at Ball's Bluff. Many more were seriously wounded, including the young Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who was brought to Chase's spacious home to recover. Baker was mourned by the entire Lincoln family. Lincoln later told the journalist Noah Brooks that the death of his beloved Baker smote upon him like a whirlwind from a desert. The day before Baker was killed, the two old friends had talked together on the White House grounds. A passing officer recalled the poignant scene. Mr. Lincoln sat on the ground leaning against a tree. Colonel Baker was lying prone on the ground, his head supported by his clasped hands. The trees and the lawns were gorgeous in purple and crimson and scarlet, like the curtains of God's tabernacle. Not far away, 10-year-old Willie was tossing the fallen leaves about in childish grace and abandon. When the time came for Baker to take his leave, he shook Lincoln's hand and then took Willie into his arms and kissed him. 24 hours later, Captain Thomas Eckert, in charge of the telegraph office at McClellan's headquarters, received word of Baker's death and the defeat at Ball's Bluff. Instructed to deliver all military telegrams directly to McClellan, Eckert searched for the commanding general. Finding him at the White House talking with Lincoln, he handed the general the wire and withdrew. McClellan chose not to reveal its contents to the president. Afterward, when Lincoln dropped in at the telegraph office to get the latest news from the front, he discovered the dispatch. A correspondent seated in the outer room observed Lincoln's reaction. He walked with bowed head and tears rolling down his furrowed cheeks, his face pale and wan, his heart heaving with emotion. He stumbled through the room and almost fell as he stepped into the street. Mary was similarly distraught. She had named her second son Edward in honor of Edward Baker. Now both her child and his dear namesake were lost. Willie and Tad, who had likewise adored Baker, were heartbroken. For Willie, much like his father, writing provided some measure of solace. He composed a small poem on the death of Colonel Edward Baker, which was published in the National Republican. After two stanzas recalling Baker's patriotic life and celebrated oratorical skills, he wrote, "No squeamish notions filled his breast. The Union was his theme. No surrender and no compromise. His day thought and night's dream. His country has her part to play towards those he has left behind. His widow and his children all she must always keep in mind." The child's homage to a cherished friend reflected a depressingly common circumstance as the war left mounting casualties and desolation in its wake. 10-year-old Willie's words would be echoed in his father's memorable plea in the second inaugural address when he urged the nation to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan. McClellan straightaway denied responsibility for the defeat at Ball's Bluff, characteristically insisting that the disaster was caused by errors committed by the leaders at the front. "The whole thing took place some 40 miles from here without my orders or knowledge," he told his wife. "It was entirely unauthorized by me, and I am in no manner responsible for it." The person directly to blame, McClellan said, was Colonel Baker, who had exceeded General Stone's orders by crossing the river. Rumors then began to spread that Stone himself would be court-martialed. When frustrated congressional leaders, many of whom were longtime friends of Baker, decried the defeat at Ball's Bluff and the general stagnation of the Union troops, the president defended McClellan. When these same leaders approached McClellan, he unleashed a diatribe against Scott, accusing him of placing obstacles at every step along his way. the congressional delegation left, vowing to remove Scott. You may have heard from the papers, etc., of the small row that is going on just now between General Scott and myself, McClellan wrote his wife, in which the vox populi is coming out strongly on my side. I hear that officers and men all declare that they will fight under no one but our George, as the scamps have taken it into their heads to call me. On November 1st, Lincoln regretfully accepted the veteran's request for retirement. The newspapers released General Scott's resignation letter, along with Lincoln's heartfelt reply. The president extolled Scott's long and brilliant career, stating that Americans would hear the news of his departure from active service with sadness and deep emotion. At the same time, Lincoln designated McClellan to succeed Scott as General-in-Chief of the Union Army. 2 days later, his objective accomplished, McClellan confessed to conflicted emotions when he accompanied Scott to the railroad station for his departure from Washington. I saw there the end of a long, active, and ambitious life, he wrote his wife, the end of the career of the first soldier of his nation, and it was a feeble old man scarce able to walk. Hardly anyone there to see him off but his successor. The truth, as the newspapers reported, was that a large crowd had assembled at the depot, despite the trains leaving at 5 a.m. in a drenching rain. All the members of Scott's staff were there, along with McClellan's complete staff and a cavalry escort. Secretaries Chase and Cameron had come to join the general on his journey to Harrisburg. Moreover, quite a number of citizens had gathered to pay their respects, belying the ignominious farewell that McClellan depicted. Once again, the young Napoleon erred in his calculations. As winter approached, public discontent with the inaction of the Union Army intensified. I do not intend to be sacrificed, the new general-in-chief wrote his wife. Now that McClellan could no longer blame Scott for his troubles, he shifted his censure to Lincoln for denying him the means to confront the rebel forces in Virginia, whose numbers, he insisted, were at least 3 times his own. In letters home, he complained about Lincoln's constant intrusions, which forced him to hide out at the home of fellow Democrat Edwin Stanton, to dodge all enemies in shape of browsing president, etc. He reported a visit to the White House one Sunday after tea, where he found the original gorilla, as he had taken to describing the president. What a specimen to be at the head of our affairs now, he ranted. I went to Seward's, where I found the gorilla again, and was of course much edified by his anecdotes, ever apropos and ever unworthy of one holding his high position. On Wednesday night, November 13th, Lincoln went with Seward and Hay to McClellan's house. Told that the general was at a wedding, the three waited in the parlor for an hour. When McClellan arrived home, the porter told him the president was waiting, but McClellan passed by the parlor room and climbed the stairs to his private quarters. After another half hour, Lincoln again sent word that he was waiting, only to be informed that the general had gone to sleep. Young John Hay was enraged. I wish here to record what I consider a portent of evil to come, he wrote in his diary, recounting what he considered an inexcusable insolence of epaulettes, the first indicator of the threatened supremacy of the military authorities. To Hay's surprise, Lincoln seemed not to have noticed it specially, saying it was better at this time not to be making points of etiquette and personal dignity. He would hold McClellan's horse, he once said, if a victory could be achieved. Though Lincoln, the consummate pragmatist, did not express anger at McClellan's rebuff, his aides fumed at every instance of such arrogance. Lincoln's secretary, William Stoddard, described the infuriating delay when he accompanied Lincoln to McClellan's anteroom. A minute passes, then another, and then another, and with every tick of the clock upon the mantel, your blood warms nearer and nearer its boiling point. Your face feels hot, and your fingers tingle, as you look at the man sitting so patiently over there, and you try to master your rebellious consciousness. As time went by, Lincoln visited the haughty general less frequently. If he wanted to talk with McClellan, he sent a summons for him to appear at the White House. During these tense days, Mary tried to distract her husband. If old friends were in town, she would invite them to breakfast and dispatch a message to his office calling the president to join the gathering. Initially irritated to be taken from his work, Lincoln would grudgingly sit down and begin exchanging stories. His mouth would relax, his eye brighten, and his whole face lighten, Elizabeth Grimsley recalled, and we would be launched into a sea of laughter. Mary had also introduced a therapeutic daily drive, insisting that the two of them, and sometimes the children, take an hour-long carriage ride at the end of the afternoon to absorb the fresh air which he so much needed. More than most previous first ladies, Mary enjoyed entertaining. She had never lost her taste for politics. On many nights, while her husband worked late in his office, the First Lady held soirees in the Blue Room, to which she invited a mostly male circle of guests. Her frequent visitors included Daniel Sickles, the New York congressman who recently had murdered the son of the composer of the Star-Spangled Banner, Philip Barton Key, who was having an affair with Sickles's wife. Defended by a team of lawyers, including Edwin Stanton, Sickles had been found innocent by reason of temporary insanity. Another flamboyant figure at Mary's salons was Henry Wyckoff, who had published an account of his picaresque adventures in Europe. He had been a spy for Britain and had spent time in jail for kidnapping and seducing a young woman. Mary enjoyed people with scandalous backgrounds and delighted in the lively conversation, which ranged from love, law, literature, and war, to gossip of courts and cabinets, of the boudoir and the salon, of commerce and the church, of the peer and the pauper, of Dickens and Thackeray. While Mary charmed guests in her evening salons, she gained respect for the energy and aplomb with which she hosted the traditional White House receptions for the public. She believed that these social gatherings helped to sustain morale. Most important, her husband was proud of both her social skills and her appearance. "My wife is as handsome as when she was a girl," he said at one White House levee, "and I, a poor nobody then, fell in love with her, and once more have never fallen out." When Prince Napoleon, the cousin of Napoleon Bonaparte III, visited Washington in early August, Mary organized an elaborate dinner party. She found the task of entertaining much simpler than it had been in Springfield days. "We only have to give our orders for the dinner and dress in proper season," she wrote her friend Hannah Shearer. Having learned French when she was young, she conversed easily with the prince. "It was a beautiful dinner," Lizzie Grimsley recalled, "beautifully served, gay conversation in which the French tongue predominated." 2 days later, her interest in French literature apparently renewed, Mary requested Volume 9 of the Œuvre de Victor Hugo from the Library of Congress. Nor did Mary Lincoln confine her abundant energies to social ventures. A month after the French dinner, she strenuously pressured her husband on a matter of state, the pending execution of William Scott. A soldier from Vermont, Scott had fallen asleep during picket duty. His dereliction of duty had occurred during the pre-dawn hours of his second straight night of standing guard. As the story was told, he had volunteered the first night to replace a sick friend, and then was called to duty the next night on his own. According to Lizzie Grimsley, the severity of the soldier's sentence distressed both Tad and his mother. "Think," Tad entreated, "if it was your own little boy who was just tired after fighting and marching all day, that he could not keep awake much as he tried to." Mary joined in, begging her husband to show mercy to the young soldier. The situation was not easy for Lincoln. While he understood the human circumstances that led to the soldiers' lapse, he also recognized that his intervention might undermine military discipline. In the end, Mary's arguments apparently swayed him. The day before the scheduled execution, Lincoln walked over to McClellan's office and asked him to issue a pardon, suggesting, the general recollected, that I could give as a reason in the order that it was by request of the lady president. Vermont Senator Lucius Chittenden, who had also interceded on young Scott's behalf, apologized for the imposition, recognizing that it was asking too much of the president to intervene in behalf of a private soldier. Lincoln put Chittenden's mind at ease, assuring him that Scott's life is as valuable to him as that of any person in the land. You remember the remark of a Scotchman about the head of a nobleman who was decapitated? It was a small matter of a head, but it was valuable to him, poor fellow, for it was the only one he had. The renovation of the White House and its surrounding landscape engaged Mary throughout the summer and fall of 1861. She raved to a friend that she had the most beautiful flowers and grounds imaginable, and company and excitement enough to turn a wiser head than my own. Yet with each passing month she spent less time with her husband, whose every hour was preoccupied with the war. Though he still took the afternoon drives she had prescribed, he often invited Seward along so the two men could talk. In late August, when Seward's wife and daughter arrived in Washington to spend several weeks, Lincoln took them for drives nearly every afternoon. Frances took an immediate liking to the president, whom she described as a plain, unassuming farmer, not awkward or ungainly, who talked with equal ease about the war and the crops. Fanny was captivated. "I liked him very much," she recorded in her diary. She was especially delighted when the president showed her the kittens her father had given to Willie and Tad, and told her that they climb all over him. During these pleasant interludes with the Seward family, Lincoln stopped to visit the various encampments in the surrounding countryside. Halting the carriages, he and Seward would talk with the soldiers. A veteran reporter, who had watched every president since Jackson, wrote that he had never seen anyone go through the routine of handshaking with the abandon of President Lincoln. He goes it with both hands, and hand over hand, very much as a sailor would climb a rope. The affable Seward was equally at ease. Fanny took particular delight in watching them greet troops from the 23rd Pennsylvania Regiment. With one impulse, the men cheered Lincoln's appearance so loudly that the horses were somewhat startled. Then they began cheering for Secretary Seward, passing his name from mouth to mouth. Fanny proudly confided in her diary that, "I love to remember all Father says and does." Frances Seward was happy to be reunited with her husband for the first extended period in almost a year. But she found the frantic pace of wartime Washington life enervating. Nor did she feel at home in the palatial house her husband had taken on Lafayette Square. In a letter to her sister, she wistfully confessed that Henry was never more pleased with a home. It accommodates itself marvelously to his tastes and habits, such as they are at this day. She praised Fred and Anna, who were so gifted in making their surroundings tasteful and attractive. But it was a home designed for the three of them, her husband, son, and daughter-in-law, not for her. It perfectly fitted the constant round of entertaining that Seward so enjoyed, and Anna was far better suited to the role of hostess than Frances, confined to her bed by migraines for several days every week, could ever hope to be. As she readied herself to return to Auburn, Frances was concerned that she had not yet called on Mary Lincoln. The First Lady had just come back from a 3-week vacation in upstate New York and Long Branch, New Jersey, and Frances felt it her duty to visit, especially as I went to see her husband. On the Monday before Frances was due to leave, word came that Mary would receive her and her family that evening. After dinner, John Nicolay arrived to escort the Sewards to the White House. The little group included Henry, Francis, Fred, Anna, and Fanny, as well as Seward's youngest son, Will, and his new bride, Jenny. They were shown into the blue parlor by Edward, the Irish doorkeeper, who had worked in the White House for nearly two decades. Edward drew a chair for Mrs. L., Fanny recalled, and then arranged the chairs for the rest of the party, before leaving to inform Mary that her guests had arrived. "Well, there we sat," Fanny recorded, "until, after a lapse of some time, the usher came and said Mrs. Lincoln begged to be excused. She was very much engaged." "The truth," Fanny wrote, "was probably that she did not want to see Mother. Else why not give general direction to the doorkeeper to let no one in? It was certainly very rude to have us all seated first." Referring to Mary's celebrated salons, Fanny archly added that it was the only time on record that she ever refused to see company in the evening. In fact, Mary detested Seward, and had most likely contrived to snub the entire Seward family. From the outset, she had resisted Seward's appointment to the cabinet, fearing that his celebrity would outshine her husband's. "If things should go on all right," she warned, "the credit would go to Seward. If they went wrong, the blame would fall upon my husband." Contrary to Mary's suspicions, it was Seward who received much of the censure incurred by the administration, as his fellow cabinet members tended to blame him more than Lincoln for whatever displeased them. Long after Seward had come to respect Lincoln's authority, however, many observers, including Mary, mistakenly assumed that the Secretary of State was the mastermind of the administration. "It makes me mad to see you sit still and let that hypocrite, Seward, twine you around his finger as if you were a skein of thread," Mary fumed to her husband. Furthermore, Mary resented the long evenings Lincoln spent at Seward's Lafayette Square mansion, rather than remaining home with her. Warmed by Seward's fireplace and gregarious personality, Lincoln could unwind. Though he himself neither drank nor smoked, he happily watched Seward light up a Havana cigar and pour a glass of brandy. And while Lincoln rarely swore, he found Seward's colorful cursing amusing. On one occasion, as Lincoln and Seward were en route to review the troops, the driver lost control of his team and began swearing with gusto. "My friend, are you an Episcopalian?" Lincoln asked. The teamster replied that he was in fact a Methodist. "Oh, excuse me," Lincoln said with a laugh. "I thought you must be an Episcopalian, for you swear just like Secretary Seward, and he's a church warden." Lincoln and Seward talked of many things besides the war. They debated the historical legacies of Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, and John Quincy Adams. Seward argued that neither Clay's nor Webster's would live a tithe as long as J.Q. Adams. Lincoln disagreed, believing that Webster will be read forever. They explored the concept of personal courage. When Lincoln spoke admiringly of the intensity of a particular soldier's desire to take on the enemy in person, Seward disagreed. He had always acted on the opposite principle, admitting you are scared and assuming that the enemy is. They traded stories and teased each other. One night when John Hay was also present, another guest brought up the Chicago Convention. Hay feared that reminding Seward of his loss was in very bad taste, but Lincoln used the remark to tell a humorous story about 1860. At one point, he related, the mayor of Chicago, John Wentworth, had feared that Lincoln was oblivious to shifting opinion in Illinois. "I tell you what," Wentworth advised, referring to Thurlow Weed, "you must do like Seward does. Get a feller to run you." Both Lincoln and Seward found the story vastly amusing. Lincoln's buoyant mood plummeted an hour or so later that evening when he received General Thomas W. Sherman's request for more troops before his advance upon Port Royal, South Carolina. Frustrated by repeated calls from every general for reinforcements, He told Seward he would refuse Sherman's request and would telegraph him to say he didn't have much hope of his expedition anyway. Now it was Seward's turn to moderate the president's reply, much as Lincoln had softened Seward's language in the famous May 21st dispatch. "No," Seward replied, "you won't say discouraging things to a man going off with his life in his hand." Lincoln rejected Sherman's request for more troops, but expressed no pessimism about the mission. The long evenings of camaraderie at Seward's, where interesting guests wandered in and out, probably rekindled memories of Lincoln's convivial days on the circuit, when he and his fellow lawyers gathered together before the log fire to talk, drink, and share stories. Between official meetings and private get-togethers, Lincoln spent more time with Seward in the first year of his presidency than with anyone else, including his family. It was not, therefore, surprising that the possessive Mary felt rancor toward Seward and his family. While Lincoln endured complaints about the lack of forward movement in the East, he was forced to confront an equally thorny situation in the West, where the fighting between secessionists and unionists in Missouri threatened to erupt into civil war. Though a majority of the state supported the Union, the new governor, Claiborne Jackson, commanded a sizable number of secessionists intent upon bringing the state into the Confederacy. Missouri initially succeeded in thwarting the rebel guerrillas, largely through the combined efforts of Frank Blair, who had left Congress to become a colonel, and his good friend, General Nathaniel Lyon. They had prevented rebel troops from seizing the St. Louis arsenal and ingeniously captured Fort Jackson, where the Confederate troops were headquartered. Lyon had entered the rebel camp on a scouting mission, disguised as the familiar figure of Frank's mother-in-law, a well-respected old lady in St. Louis. He wore a dress and shawl, with a thickly veiled sunbonnet to hide his red beard. Hidden in his egg basket were revolvers in case he was recognized. The following day, with knowledge of the camp and 7,000 troops, Lyon marched in and took the fort. In spite of these early successes, daring rebel raids soon destroyed bridges, roads, and property, and threw the state into a panic. To take charge of this perilous situation and command the entire Department of the West, Lincoln appointed General John C. Fremont, the dashing hero whose exploits in 1847 in the liberation of California from Mexico had earned him the first Republican nomination for president in 1856. Lincoln later recalled that it was upon the earnest solicitation and united advocacy of the powerful Blair family that he made Fremont a major general and sent him to Missouri. Fremont's appointment was initially greeted with enthusiasm. "He is just such a person as Western men will idolize and follow through every danger to death or victory," John Hay wrote. "He is upright, brave, generous, enterprising, learned, and eminently practical." Fremont's staunch anti-slavery principles found favor among the German Americans, who comprised a large portion of the St. Louis population. "There was a sort of romantic halo about him," Gustav Kerner recalled. "His name alone had a magical influence, inducing thousands of volunteers from the western states to join the Union Army." Within weeks of Fremont's arrival, however, stories filtered back to Washington of recklessness in expenditures. Tales circulated that the Fremonts had set themselves up in a $6,000 mansion, where bodyguards deterred unwanted visitors, including Hamilton Gamble, the former Unionist governor of Missouri and brother-in-law of Edward Bates. Some worried that Fremont, like McClellan, had chosen to stay in the city to prepare for a move against the rebels, rather than join his troops in the field. These unsettling rumors were followed by the shocking news of General Lyon's death in a struggle at Wilson's Creek on August 10th. Weeks later, the Union forces suffered another devastating defeat, when they were forced to surrender Lexington to the rebels.